This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our daily webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today to learn more about investing in healthcare stocks. My guest is Barron's healthcare reporter, Josh Nathan Casis. There's been some exciting news today on the COVID vaccine front. A booster dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine appears to have a 95.6% efficacy against COVID in a phase 3 trial, the company's reported. Josh will tell us what that means and more, and we encourage you to send in questions while he's speaking, and we'll be happy to answer them at the end of the call. Welcome to Josh. Thanks for joining me on Barron's Live today.
Thanks so much, Lauren. It's great to be here. Yeah, the booster news this morning from Pfizer was really good. I mean, so far, you know, we'd only had immunogenicity data on these boosters for the most part. That's where you sort of give someone a booster dose and then compare the immune response in their blood, essentially, between, you know, people who got the booster and people who didn't. But this is like a real randomized controls trial. There was one group of people who had gotten the Pfizer vaccine and then got the booster, and another group of people who had the Pfizer vaccine and then got a placebo. And there were 5 cases of COVID in the booster group and 109 in the placebo group. So that's a relative efficacy between those who just had 2 and those who had 3 of 95.5%. Now, we should say very clearly, this is symptomatic COVID. It is not severe disease. Pfizer didn't really disclose any data, as far as I could tell from the press release, about any severe cases in the non-booster group. But the bottom line we should still remember that 2 doses is still effective against severe disease. But this does seem to suggest that 3 doses of Pfizer works quite well at preventing many cases of symptomatic disease.
Fantastic. So what's the next step here?
Well, the immediate next step, which we can talk about in a minute, is that the CDC's advisory committee is meeting as we speak to discuss Moderna boosters, Johnson & Johnson boosters, and mix and match boosters. After that, you know, I think there's some questions about whether the availability of the Pfizer booster may or may not be expanded beyond the relatively, but not so narrow, category for which it's now available. And that is people who are 65 and above and people 18 to 64 with certain risk factors, including health risk factors and occupational risk factors. There was some conversation at a FDA advisory committee meeting about expanding it to 40-year-olds and up. But anyway, that's all to be seen. And I'm not even sure we know when the advisory committee would meet to discuss that.
Well, the data is certainly very compelling. So that's quite encouraging. Let's get an update on the rest of the COVID landscape before we delve into more about boosters, vaccines, and so forth.
Well, the short-term news is good. COVID cases are still trending down. New daily cases of COVID are trending down. That's about down 22% over the last 2 weeks in the U.S. And hospitalizations, which is even better, is down 19%. But we should still remember that we're averaging something like 79,000 new cases of COVID today, per day, rather. And that is still, you know, worse than all but the worst period of the pandemic. So, you know, November to 2020 to February 2021, we had more new cases daily, but in no other period besides, you know, this current August to today, Delta surge, has it been so bad. So better than it was, but it's still one of the worst months of the pandemic in terms of, you know, new cases nationwide. And globally, cases are dropping too. It's down about 9% over the last 2 weeks.
Is there much concern that we'll see a surge after Thanksgiving and family gatherings and so forth?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it goes back to this broad question about what's going to happen over the winter and are we going to see another winter surge? I hope not.
I hope not as well. So to continue on with non-COVID topics before we circle back, let's talk about Biogen. This is a biotech stock that's been the subject of a couple of big stories this week that you've been reporting on. Tell us the latest from Biogen.
Yeah, so Biogen's been probably the biggest non-COVID biotech story this year. The stock is up 9.8% this year, last I looked, but it's down about 22% since the start of July. And what you'll listeners will may recall is that this is the company that got a, you know, the first Alzheimer's disease therapy in many, many years approved earlier this year in June. And there was a huge amount of investor excitement over it, but it was met very rapidly with some substantial criticism and concern. The news on the Aduhelm front, that's the name of this therapy, is that the company reported earnings yesterday and they only sold $300,000 worth of Aduhelm in the third quarter. The FactSet analyst consensus was $12 million for the third quarter.
Okay, so something went wrong there.
It's a pretty big miss. Yeah. It's not a huge shock that sales are soft. There was a big stat. The healthcare news website had a big scoop last month that only 100 people had received Aduhelm as of early September. And this is in the context of a lot of pushback on Aduhelm. You know, the price is very high. The data that we have really doesn't show that it works. It doesn't show that it has clinical efficacy. It does show that it does something in the brain that people think, you know, should help Alzheimer's patients slow their decline. But the actual studies that were done are not conclusive, I think is a good way to put it. And the FDA's scientific advisors thought they did not, that Biogen had not shown clinical efficacy. And in fact, when the FDA approved it, they approved it on the basis of so-called biomarkers, not a trial saying that it worked. So that's one concern. And that's led to a number of things in the last few months. There are healthcare systems in the US that have said they won't administer it. There are insurers that are not paying for it. And
Medicare?
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which administers the Medicare program, has started what's called the National Coverage Determination Process.
And sounds ominous.
This is not a thing they do often, but this is where they are going to make a nationwide decision about how they're going to handle Aduhelm and similar drugs, although there are no similar drugs right now. And it seems like, you know, what Biogen is saying is they sort of think that sales are basically on hold, that the rollout is going to be really slow until that national coverage determination is done next April. And at that point, you know, they think that, you know, doctors and practices and hospitals are going to be more comfortable prescribing and administering this drug if, you know, they know how it's going to be covered. You know, Biogen is saying, hold on and things will clear up then. But of course, that process could go either way. There was some analysts on the investor call yesterday asking if Biogen was thinking about cutting the price because it's quite expensive. I forget the number. I think it's like 60-something thousand.
I thought it was about 56,000.
That's right. That's correct. Thanks. Yeah. And they said no. You know, we think the real issue here is the national coverage termination is ongoing. So you know, the company is looking towards that. But in the meantime, you know, I think a lot of the early enthusiasm for this drug has, or at least investor enthusiasm rather, has faded. The other thing is that the Alzheimer's landscape is shifting a little bit. You know, the approval of, sorry about the siren in the background.
That's all right. You're in New York City.
The approval of Biogen's drug gave other companies with similar drugs in development some hope that they could get theirs approved quickly. So Eli Lilly is expected to submit for approval of their similar amyloid beta antibody called donanemab in the next few months. And there's a Roche one. So by the time the national coverage determination is done, you know, I mean, this will still be the only Alzheimer's therapy, but there will be others coming pretty quickly on its heels, most likely.
And hopefully they will work a bit better.
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. We'll have to see the data.
Biogen also had an ALS disappointment this past week, didn't it?
Yeah, and this was, I think, really disappointing for ALS patients. This is a drug that Biogen had been developing with a partner called Ionis Pharma. The sort of top line data here was not positive. Biogen said they saw positive trends deeper in the data, but the sort of main endpoint of slowing disease progression was not met. Biogen seems to be pretty optimistic that there is still a use for this drug. They're going to keep studying it. They saw some signals within their study, but shares of Ionis, the partner, fell pretty sharply. So, you know, that was a little disappointing earlier this week.
So it's been a tough time for Biogen. What happens next? What does the company have next in its pipeline? Where is it headed now?
I think investors are still pretty focused on Aduhelm. I mean, that's really the big thing. The problem that Biogen's been facing is that they just have a lot of drugs that are facing a lot of competition. Their whole MS franchise, their spinal muscular atrophy drug, sales are declining, and they're really counting on Aduhelm. And I don't think the company or the Biogen bulls are writing that off by any means. I think that investors are really just focused on if and when these sales pick up. And Biogen says that they will pick up after the first year or so.
So it's kind of a real tug of war over the stock.
Yeah, well, yeah. And you know, as you can see, it's still up on the year. But that big surge it had in June is fading away. Yeah.
So you've also been writing a lot about antivirals for COVID. It's a tricky area. There have been mixed results from drug companies. Recently, Atea Pharmaceuticals, the ticker is AVIR, tested an antiviral with disappointing results. Tell us more about that, Josh.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about these COVID antivirals. There's really three that have been getting most of the attention. The Merck's molnupiravir, which everyone now knows about, a Pfizer drug with a impossible to say name, and Atea's drug. Atea is a biotech that has partnered with Roche, and their antiviral returned some phase two data earlier this week. And what they said was that it did not reduce. So this was data where they weren't like looking at clinical outcomes in the same way as the molnupiravir trial that came out in early October that really shook up the market. We can talk about that in a moment. They were looking at viral load here, and what they found was that the drug did not reduce the viral load of their patients with mild or moderate cases of COVID. They did say that in a subgroup within the trial of high-risk patients, it did reduce the viral load, but the overall population, which were mostly low-risk patients with mild to moderate symptoms, they didn't see that reduction. Now, let me just mention the Merck trial, and I have been referring to it. You know, Merck announced with great fanfare and earlier this month that their drug molnupiravir in this group of high-risk patients had reduced hospitalization by 50%, and they have now submitted that drug for emergency use authorization from the FDA. There's all sorts of reasons why the Atea trial and the Merck trial are not great to compare with each other, and there's actually been a lot of questions raised in the past couple of days about Atea's study design. But the bottom line is that Atea now says that their phase three trial, which they'd started already, now, instead of being done at the end of this year, it's not going to be done until the second half of next year. So they really pushed out the timeline on this. This is now no longer going to be part of this first wave of COVID antivirals. At least, I guess we're assuming that the molnupiravir will make it to the market in some form, which I think we can assume. And Atea, it looks like, you know, really will not be competing with molnupiravir in the near term. And that's a bummer because, you know, just from my public health perspective, the world needs oral COVID antivirals.
Sure.
You know, right now, all of the therapeutics for COVID are pretty inconvenient. You know, as we said before, most of them, you need to get an infusion, you need to go to the hospital. An oral antiviral like molnupiravir or Atea's drug, you could get a prescription from your doctor as soon as you start feeling symptoms. And if it worked, you could really eat away at some of the mortality that we see and the hospitalizations we see. So it's not great. It wasn't great for investors either. The stock fell 66% on Tuesday from $40 to $11, which is a pretty dramatic drop for this company. And Merck shares rose 3% because, you know, they knocked out this competitor.
Yes.
And also, yeah. You know, we've spoken a bit about these theoretical safety concerns with molnupiravir. Merck says that they're convinced they're not an issue. But there had been an idea that just because they exist in theory, and some scientists have raised them, you know, if Atea's efficacy were as good as molnupiravir's, it may win out in the marketplace. It could theoretically have won out in the marketplace because of those, you know, theoretical safety concerns. But that is not going to happen anymore, at least in the near term. And so Merck shares were up about 3% that day.
So Merck has a lot of products. It's got a huge pipeline. Very different company from Atea. What else is Atea working on? Does it have any other products or a pipeline to support even its much reduced valuation?
It's a pretty small biotech. I don't know the market cap outside of my head. They're clinical stage companies, so they do not have any approved drugs at this time. They do have a pipeline of antivirals that use the same general approach. I think they're working on dengue, RSV, hepatitis C. I'm not a huge expert, but certainly not their only program, but it is the one that was closest to market and the one that was that had the most investor interest, for sure.
Big disappointment for the company and its investors. So yeah. Let's get back to boosters, which we talked about earlier. The FDA has been extremely busy reviewing and approving products, and you've been very busy writing about them. So give us a status update. What is happening with COVID boosters these days?
So last night at something like 5:15. I know because I was picking up my kids from school and had to run home and write it up. The FDA authorized boosters for Moderna and Johnson & Johnson's vaccines last night. They also issued this very broad authorization for so-called mix and match boosters. We can get back to what that means in a moment, but right now, as we speak, the CDC's advisory committee is considering those same questions and will vote today before 5 o'clock. So we can expect, an announcement from the CDC with recommendations that would allow a rollout of these boosters to begin, late tonight or tomorrow. So what's happened here is not wholly unexpected, not unexpected, particularly with regard to Moderna and Johnson & Johnson. Moderna's booster got authorized from the FDA along the exact same lines as Pfizer's booster. That was basically a fait accompli. Like even at the meeting last week on Thursday, some of the members of the FDA's advisory committee basically said like they didn't feel like they even had a choice in terms of whether to authorize this booster because they'd already done given Pfizer's the authorization, and it would sort of not make sense to only do one. So that's exactly the same as Pfizer authorization. It's just for adults 65 and older. And then people aged 18 to 64 based on risk conditions, including employment. The Johnson & Johnson one is different. That is a second dose after 2 months for anybody who received Johnson & Johnson. That's anybody age 18 and up. It was never authorized for younger people. But you don't need to be special job or whatever. Anybody can get the Johnson & Johnson booster. And that is because, as many of the members of the advisory committee said on Friday, seems like Johnson & Johnson's vaccine was really always a two-dose vaccine, although it was rolled out as a one-and-done shot, and that's still how Johnson & Johnson frames it. The advisors thought that the data they saw showed that people really should get two doses of that one. Now, the mix-and-match thing is new, and as recently as a couple of weeks ago, when CDC's advisory committee asked why they couldn't recommend mix-and-match boosting, the FDA said, we don't have enough data. What's changed is that the NIH has sponsored a study that's begun to produce data on mix and match boosting. And just
to explain, can you give...
Yeah, sorry. So that's just...
An explanation of what mix and match is. It sounds like the ready-to-wear business.
Yeah, sorry. No, it's just like if you got Johnson & Johnson for your prime dose, getting Moderna for your booster. So getting one for the prime and one for the booster. It is not, by the way, getting a prime of Moderna and then Pfizer. That's not allowed. It's getting Moderna for one and two, and then Pfizer for your boost.
So it relates to the third.
It's the third, or I guess Johnson & Johnson's case, the second. And what the FDA said last night was basically, do what you want.
Well, that's comforting.
With certain limits. No, but just in terms of mix and match boosting. So the FDA advisors had a discussion about mix and match boosting after hearing a presentation on the NIH data. They didn't vote, but based on the tenor of the discussion, I guess the FDA felt like they could go forward with the recommendation. Most of the members did seem to be generally supportive of it. And what they've said is that if you got Moderna or Pfizer and you're eligible for a booster, which means you're either over 65 or you have certain jobs or risk factors and you're younger than 65, then you can get the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson booster. Similarly, if you got Johnson & Johnson and you're eligible for a booster, which means it's been 2 months and you're of any age, then you can get Moderna or Pfizer or Johnson & Johnson booster. Now, the CDC committee is meeting today, and it does seem like they are going to recommend boosters for Moderna and Johnson & Johnson, but there is language in their presentations that makes it seem like they may not recommend, their recommendation might be narrower for mix and match boosting. And because of the intricacies of the way emergency use authorizations work, if what they come down with is a bit narrower at the end of the day today, then the mix and match regime is going to be narrower. So we don't really know what mix and match is going to look like until the CDC advisors vote and the CDC director signs off on it tonight. So that is a little bit up in the air. But I think the bottom line here is that, you know, just in terms of market share, this really cements the status quo, which is that Pfizer really has the lion's share of the market, followed by Moderna, with Johnson & Johnson way in the back. I mean, the early data from NIH suggests that you get more protection if you first got Johnson & Johnson by following with a Moderna or Pfizer boost than by getting a Johnson & Johnson boost. So it seems as though the booster market is going to go more to the mRNA-based vaccines. And then, as SVB Leerink analyst Jeffrey Porges has argued, the fact that Pfizer's booster dose is the same size as its prime doses compared to Moderna's, which is half the size of its prime doses, actually favors Pfizer in the booster market because it's simpler in terms of administration for healthcare providers that are, you know, stocking this stuff. So Porges, and I think correctly, argues that Pfizer will continue to be, this is going to cement Pfizer's position as kind of the biggest player in the COVID vaccine market, at least in the U.S.
Fascinating. It's quite a battle. Has there been much of an impact on J&J stock from all of this?
Well, you know, the thing about J&J, as we've said, is that they are selling their vaccine on a not-for-profit basis, so it really shouldn't have much of an impact on their stock.
And they're a giant with so many other business lines.
Right. You know, they had earnings this week. I mean, it shouldn't be a huge driver of their share price.
So one big problem in our fight against COVID has been a lack of vaccines for children. That's been a particular issue in thinking about reopening schools, but that's about to change. So tell us where things stand with children's vaccines.
Yeah, so the news here is that the White House announced their rollout plan for Pfizer's vaccine for children aged 5 to 11. That's about 28 million people. The timeline is that the FDA's advisory committee is meeting, I believe, next Tuesday to discuss whether this should be authorized. And the CDC's advisory committee is meeting the following week, which suggests that a rollout could start for this age category could start in early November. And the White House says that they're really going to try to focus on administration in places that feel comfortable to families, where they can sort of build trust. So they're sending, they're enlisting 25,000 pediatricians' offices, schools, children's hospitals, places like that. And these doses are going to be a third the size of the adult dose, and they'll be packaged separately.
And you get a lollipop afterwards.
They say they're sending special needles for kids. I'm not sure they're sending the lollipops. That might be a thing for the doctors.
Not an FDA decision. Yeah.
So anyway, that could come in early November. And that would be, so that's on the way.
All right. That sounds good. That's very promising. There are a couple of other companies I wanted to talk about, and then we'll take a look at the healthcare market generally and how stocks have been performing. Valneva is a French vaccine company that you've highlighted for its Lyme vaccine. It recently got positive results on a COVID vaccine. What's going on there?
Yeah, so they have what's called an inactivated virus vaccine, sort of a more traditional vaccine technology. It's the only one in trials for COVID in Europe, although the one of the Chinese vaccines, Sinovac's CoronaVac, is an inactivated virus vaccine. There's sort of been a roller coaster ride for Valneva on this. They had a deal with the UK government to procure their COVID vaccine, and then it was canceled. Valneva shares plummeted. Now it looks like the vaccine did pretty well in a study against AstraZeneca's vaccine, and the stock was up like 40% on Monday. It was up again on Wednesday. The data says not huge. It may not be enough for approval, according to some analysts, but you know, this stock has been a roller coaster on its COVID vaccine, and the ride does not seem to be stopping.
All right. And then there's CureVac, which has also encountered some problems.
Yeah, CureVac. So this is one of the original mRNA companies from back before COVID. They have a COVID vaccine that returned some pretty disappointing data back in June, and now they are finally pulling the plug on it. They say they're not going to continue to develop it. They say it has to do with regulatory timelines, but they're also working on another mRNA-based COVID vaccine, that one, the second one, in partnership with GlaxoSmithKline. And so they're sort of focusing on that one. So that's the development from CureVac. And it's sort of, you know, it's interesting, like, not only was the world lucky that mRNA-based vaccines work, but also that, like, the mRNA approach that BioNTech and Moderna took was not the, you know, it was apparently a different approach in certain ways than the CureVac approach. And it seems like, you know, the world lucked out that these companies did it in different ways. There are technical differences between this vaccine and that vaccine we don't need to get into, but it's just lucky that, you know, there were two that tried the other way as CureVac failed.
As Moderna will tell you, this is not something that happened overnight. This is 10 or 12 years worth of research.
Yeah, but for all these companies, you know, I mean, CureVac was out there. When I did my cover story on messenger RNA in the summer of 2019, CureVac was one of the companies that we looked at.
Interesting. So we'll wrap up with Novavax, which is having some serious production troubles, it seems. What's going on there?
This is one of those mysteries. Novavax, as you may recall, back in the spring had some very promising data on their COVID vaccine,
yes,
protein subunit vaccine. And it's kind of this ongoing mystery of why it hasn't hit the market yet. Politico reported earlier this week that they were having some real production troubles. Has to do with, according to their reporting, having to do with consistency with this sort of the assays, the tests they used to make sure that their vaccine was good enough as it came off the line. The stock fell on Wednesday. Then Novavax put out a statement saying their regulatory filings remain on track. They've made progress. They are now consistently making a high quality product. You know, I it's been a long time, and I wonder if investors are beginning to run out of patience, but there is some hope, I think, that this vaccine could play an important role, especially as a booster around the world. And so, you know, hopefully they get it together and are able to bring this to market at some point.
And how's the stock doing?
It was down when I last looked Wednesday, but it's down on the year pretty substantially. Hold on, let me just pull it up. I don't know off the top of my head. It's up a little bit today, but I'm sorry. It's up 20% this year, but it's been very rocky.
Can imagine for good reason. Yes. So we have a question from Adnan. He asks, are there any other companies besides Biogen working on Alzheimer's drugs? I think you mentioned a few. It's worth maybe just quickly summarizing them again.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton. I mean, it's always been a very tricky indication, but now there's been some more hope, particularly, you know, given the FDA's apparent thinking on Aduhelm. So Lilly has a very similar drug called donanemab. Roche has a similar drug called gantrenimab. There's another drug from Biogen that I think they've partnered with, also with Eisai. I'm not going to say the name because I'm going to mess it up.
You're doing well. Quit while you're ahead.
And then there's plenty of others that work differently. So these ones I listed are all target amyloid beta in the brain, but there are other ways to target it and other approaches. There's a ton of Alzheimer's stocks out there.
But you could argue it's one of the largest unmet needs, and partly complicated by the fact that we're not 100% sure what causes the disease.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. It's tremendous disease burden, hugely tragic for millions of people. And, you know, a really good Alzheimer's drug would be a miracle.
Right. Right. It would be the COVID vaccine of its genre, so to speak. So I want to wrap up, Josh, by talking briefly about the stock market. The S&P 500 is up almost 22% this year. There's been tremendous developments in the healthcare sector with new drugs, new vaccines, new diagnostics, et cetera. And yet the stocks have been doing quite poorly relative to the S&P. Maybe you can run down some of the big healthcare indexes and give me your thoughts on what's gone wrong here.
Sure. So as you say, the S&P is up something like 21%. The S&P 500 healthcare sector index. So that's, companies in the S&P 500 that are in the healthcare business is up 14%. So lagging the broader index. The IBB, this is a biotech ETF that tracks, it's pretty focused on the large cap biotechs. It's up 4% this year. The XBI, another biotech ETF, this one is sort of concentrated in small and mid cap biotech. That's down 12%. T. Rowe Price's Health Sciences mutual fund, PRHSX, is up 11.7% as of yesterday. And Vanguard's healthcare fund is up about 8%. So look, I think the problem is there's no one answer. You know, we could talk specifically about biotech and run through some of the issues there. We could talk more broadly about healthcare. I think you always have to talk about, you know, the drug pricing debate. That overhang has been part of the pharmaceutical and biotech investor landscape for years, and it's certainly back this year. There had been some questions about what's going on at the FDA and, you know, the lack of an FDA commissioner, some questions about the FDA's broader approach that I think had potentially been having an impact earlier this year. I think there's really no one answer when we look at what's happening here. You know, if you talk to people about small and mid-cap biotech names, they'll say that the flood of IPOs has left less capital in some of the funds that focus on biotech to invest in the existing mid-cap and small-cap names. There's just been some discrete disappointments. And there are a number of stocks that are down pretty sharply for various, you know, news-based, development-based reasons that are just legitimately pushing these stocks down.
So what, when you speak to your sources, what is their outlook for the year ahead? Do they see the sector rebounding?
I think it's mixed. I haven't seen anyone saying it's definitely coming back. But the other thing is, if we look at a longer window, if we look at the 1 year window rather than the year-to-date window, it's a little bit better. So part of this may just be the bias of where we are in the year compared to, what the market was like at this time last year.
It's quite astounding because I remember when we held our healthcare roundtable earlier this fall, our panelists were just exuberant about developments ahead in the healthcare sector. And yet it's not reflected in the stocks.
It's true. But, you know, I think, you know, when you're thinking about the potential for long-term developments, like some of them are, you know, the advances in biotech, this stuff takes a long time. These companies take a long time to mature, and it doesn't, investors and sometimes have shorter time frames than might be appropriate or useful if you're thinking about these sort of long-term developments.
Right. Why would you want to wait around 10 years when you can buy Amazon or Facebook today?
Yeah, I think that's certainly
Microsoft
part of it.
Or
yeah.
Netflix.
Right.
So I want to close with a question that just came in from Gio. I think it's a good one. I have no idea what the answer is. What is the chance, he asks, that the mRNA approach of Moderna and Pfizer will work on cancer?
Yeah, this is something that Moderna and BioNTech, which is Pfizer's partner, are both working on. Ugur Sahin, CEO and founder of BioNTech, you know, that was originally really a cancer-focused company, and they are running lots of trials, and hopefully it works. It all works a little bit differently than the vaccines, but I think there's a lot of hope for messenger RNA-based cancer therapies, not this year or next, but sometime in the future.
Thanks for that, and we'll leave it with hope. Appreciate your information today, Josh. Thanks for participating.
Great talking.
Thank you to our listeners as well. Please join us again tomorrow for a call with Investor's Business Daily reporters Ed Carson and Alyssa Corum. They'll discuss stocks set to capture Wall Street's attention next week, a big week for earnings announcements from tech giants like Alphabet, Apple, and Facebook, and why market conditions are crucial when looking for the best stocks to buy. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in today. Stay well and have a good day.